Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Adam Grant is the author of Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. It's a New York Times bestseller, NPR and Amazon best book of 2016, and it's now available in paperback. Originals is a book about the trailblazers, the groundbreakers, those among us who use fear and doubt and barriers to their advantage, reimagining and recreating everything from technology to their own careers. Adam Grant joins us now via phone from Philadelphia. Adam, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
At this point in your career, you're also the author of Give and Take. You could write about anything. What drew you to nonconformists?
In some ways, I was curious because I'm a conformist. As long as I can remember. In elementary school, I was called to the principal's office. I got there, found out I was not in trouble, and I still cried.
Oh.
And maybe you can relate, Lori.
Yep.
I followed not only the rules, but also the rules that didn't exist yet, just in case somebody created them one day.
Oh, my heart.
Yes. So I was, I was just struck that nonconformists are really the people who shake things up, right, who drive a lot of the creativity and change in the world. And I wanted to know, how could we all become a little bit more like them and do a little bit more to try to challenge things that don't make sense. So here we are.
Here we are. In third grade, my daughter turned herself in for skipping in the hallways and asked the teacher to punish her. So she lost her recess because she had told the teacher she had been skipping. So I can relate to that as a child and as a parent. So we'll talk about parenting in a few minutes. But was there a lot of research that you were able to find right away and how these sort of folks who shake things up do what they do? Or did you have to go out and do a lot of digging and recreating of research?
It was a combination of the two. So I had spent a number of years studying how people do this in the workplace and had lots of interesting evidence on that. And then, I had to do some more digging to figure out what do we know about parenting and also, how do you think about building an effective movement if you're trying to gain allies and, have more influence. So those are some topics I hadn't really explored much before. And it was a really fun opportunity to step outside my comfort zone a little bit.
Did you get the sense, or do you have the sense now, that the world sort of needs this book?
I think needs is a strong word. I think a lot of people like to say that the pen is mightier than the sword.
Sure.
I don't know if that's true. I do think that the ink of a pen lasts longer, and it's really hard for a sword to go viral. So in that sense, I feel like books can have a lot of impact. I know they've certainly had a life-changing impact on me. I do think that we're living in a world now where creative destruction and disruption are valued more than ever before. Uh-huh. Innovation is an imperative for every kind of organization, and yet we also see more and more pressure for people to conform. If you look at, for example, college students, how they feel that there are certain narrow career paths that they're supposed to go into, and they're afraid of breaking from the norm there. And so I think at some level we do need more of this than we did before, but I'm biased.
On the flip side of that, is there a mythology of nonconformists that needs to be addressed too?
Oh, yeah. It's a mythology that we've all been exposed to at some point and probably even contributed to, mm-hmm. which says, basically, if you want to be a nonconformist, if you want to be a really original thinker, you have to be cut from a different cloth. You need to have brilliant ideas and eureka moments. You need to feel no doubt, no fear, have complete conviction in your ideas. And you need to be totally committed, and you need to act early. Hmm. And none of these things are true. When I was doing the research for Originals, that the more original you are, the more you are likely to procrastinate, have bad ideas, and be really uncertain about whether they're worth pursuing.
How about the sense of just how we present ourselves to the world? And if someone is a nonconformist at one time, an original thinker, are they always one? That kind of touches back to what you were saying about bad ideas. These people don't have good ideas every single day.
Exactly. I think, it's unfortunate that we don't get to see all the harebrained ideas that Steve Jobs produced, right? And I think that it's always domain specific. Sure. You know, in Jobs' case, he wanted to invest $63 million in a revolutionary technology that turned out to be the Segway.
I love that story in the book. You really dig into the development of the Segway. And I'm kind of sold on it, too, but yet I know it's the Segway, so I know how the story ends. Why pick something sort of iconic like that and, you know, disassemble it and sort of look at it and see what went wrong? What's the advantage of digging into a story such as, you know, the launch of the Segway?
So I wrote Originals really thinking about it as a sequel to creativity, knowing that we have a lot of guidance for how to come up with ideas, and nobody tells us what to do after we have ideas. Like, how do we know if it's any good?
Right.
Is the first question. I think this is where a lot of creativity goes to die, is, you know, we have tons of original ideas in the world, but people bet on the wrong ones constantly. And we do this with our own ideas. We do it with other people's ideas, you know, rejecting good ones and accepting bad ones. And so when I was working on the idea selection chapter, I started thinking about, you know, what are some extreme examples of false positives and false negatives? And so I picked Seinfeld as, you know, the idea that turned out to be really, really extraordinary, that was rejected over and over again. And then I wanted an opposite of that. And the reason the Segway stuck out at me was, I remember I was in high school when there was this big announcement that there was going to be a technology that was going to do to the car what the car did to the horse and buggy.
Right.
And I remember it being all over the newspapers, and all these famous people were investing in it and predicting, you know, that it would be really great. And, you know, I think now it's very popular among mall cops.
Right.
I don't see it very, very many other places. And so I was just curious about it. Like, where did, you know, Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and other really great innovators go wrong? What did they miss? And what can we learn about how to judge ideas from that? So here we are.
So how good are we at judging our own creative ideas?
Pretty terrible. It's so easy to fall in love with our own ideas. And it's very hard to see the weaknesses in them. I think one way we can get around this is there's some brand new data from a former student of mine, Justin Berg, who found that if you make a list of all the ideas you're thinking about pursuing and you rank them from your favorite to least favorite, your most promising idea is usually the one you rank not first, but second.
Really?
And I think what happens is the first idea is the one where you're most blind, right? You're just, you're so passionate about it that you really can't see it clearly. Second idea, you have a little more distance. You can judge it accurately, and you're still enthusiastic enough about it to make it work. Mm. And yeah, I'm always afraid when I think about this that, you know, people will be like, okay, I'm going to take my favorite idea and I'm going to rank it second, and then I can pick it. I don't think you can game the system that
game
way,
the system,
but I do
right?
think sometimes our next favorite ideas are the way to go.
Yeah, let's talk about, you mentioned Seinfeld, and Seinfeld is really saved by someone who is outside the normal parameters of sitcom development. How important is that fresh perspective to sort of recognizing that an idea has value?
I think it's critical. So in the Seinfeld case, the NBC executives who rejected the pilot said, you know, this breaks all the rules of sitcoms. It's a show about nothing. The plot lines never get resolved. I can't relate to any of the characters. I don't even like any of them. And It took Rick Ledwin, an executive who didn't even work in sitcoms, he was in Variety and Specials, to say, you know, I realized that's all true, but the show made me laugh. And that's what a sitcom is supposed to do. And, you know, I think that so often, right, it's people who come to a domain with a fresh perspective, who don't take for granted all the assumptions that, you know, that everybody else holds, who's able to do something really innovative.
So who are we looking for in our team of people to provide feedback? We don't want just doubters or people who know nothing about, you know, what we're working on, but we don't necessarily want those insiders. Who's on our team that's going to, you know, help us move in the right direction?
Oftentimes the best judges of ideas are people with moderate expertise in the domain. Hmm. So you don't want them to be the people who know the most. It's helpful to know something. And so, you know, like if you take Rick as an example, he's great because he still works in TV, right? He still understands, you know, from a Variety and Specials perspective, what people find funny. And I think, you know, that kind of insider-outsider is often a really good judge. The other thing that I find really striking is a lot of us make the mistake of going to the really agreeable people in our lives, you know, who are friendly and warm and nice and polite. And we expect them to be cheerleaders. And they are when we talk to them face to face. But then they're afraid of conflict, and they tend not to be the most committed advocates. It's the disagreeable people who are more critical, skeptical, and challenging who will tear the idea apart. But if you can get them excited about it, they will run through walls with you, for you to try to make it happen. And they end up being sometimes our most committed allies.
What about negativity? Does that ever tip the scales too far in the other direction, or someone's sort of adversarial and then just plain sour?
It really depends on how the negativity is perceived. If it's perceived as a personal attack and people are threatened by it, egos get in the way.
Sure.
If it's perceived as debate, then it tends to work really well. And in fact, there's some research on brainstorming suggesting that like one of the classic rules of brainstorming, which is don't criticize, actually backfires. If you encourage people to be critical and talk about what they dislike as well as what they like about ideas, then you raise the standards of everybody in the group, and you're more likely to get good ideas.
Interesting. So let's go back to that child that you were and sort of thinking that there were people who were nonconformists and creative and original, and it wasn't you. Obviously, you've changed. So this is not a fixed sort of thing genetically at birth, that some people are just born with it and some are not. Tell me about that.
Yeah, all I can say is I hope I've become less unoriginal over time. And I think that, you know, look, there are always nature effects, but nurture effects are really strong here. And, you know, we can all boost our originality wherever we start. And I think one of the first things to do is to diversify your base of experience. Steve Jobs actually said it back in 1982 really well. He said, look, if you want to be creative, you have to have a different bag of experiences than everybody else. Otherwise, you're just going to come up with the same ideas as everybody else. And my favorite example of this is if you're a scientist and you want to win the Nobel Prize, your odds go up if you have artistic hobbies. So Nobel Prize winning scientists are twice as likely as their peers to play a musical instrument. They're 7 times as likely to draw or paint. They're 12 times as likely to write fiction or poetry. And get this, 22 times as likely to act, dance, or perform as magicians.
Really?
Yeah, as a former magician, I was incredibly excited by this particular study.
Yeah, you were like, I'm on my way now. What is it about magic?
Here we go. But, you know, what's so interesting is, you know, some of this is just like curious people having lots of different hobbies.
Sure.
But there's evidence that engagement in the arts can make you a better scientist. Galileo recognized mountains on the moon in part because he was trained to recognize in a drawing technique shading as a source of elevation. And he looked at an image that other astronomers had seen, and they didn't notice anything special about it. He realized that the darker and lighter parts on the moon had to mean that there were taller and shorter objects, and boom, huge discovery.
Huh.
Einstein said that his theory of relativity was a musical theory, and had he not played the violin growing up, he never would have transformed physics. And I think that so often these hobbies that we think are unrelated to our work or to the projects that we're engaged in actually end up giving us new ideas and new ways of thinking.
So let's talk about risk then. Are these, to be an original thinker, are you inherently a risk taker?
I always thought you had to be. But it turns out that if you look at successful entrepreneurs, they don't like risk any more than the rest of us do. In fact, if anything, they tend to dislike risk a little bit more. And what they do is they just think about risk a little bit differently from the rest of us. They think about it like a stock portfolio. So if you were going to go bet on, you know, some big gamble that had a very low chance of success, you would know to offset that by buying some boring mutual funds, right?
Sure.
And sort of playing it safe with your other investments. And this is exactly how a lot of successful originals think about risk, is they say, look, I'm going to try something really radical in this one way, but I don't like to stick my neck out. And so everything else I do is going to be extra safe to protect myself and cover my bases. And yeah, I think they just manage risk as opposed to craving it.
And that goes back to sort of this mythology, because one of the sort of famous mantras in the writing world is that you write by the light of the bridges that are burning behind you, and that sort of quit your day job and just go live in a trailer and write your novel. And you're saying that maybe, and J.K. Rowling, who you sort of bring up as an example of a highly original thinker, you know, she's on welfare when she starts Harry Potter. She's working in a coffee shop.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how often that happens.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the sad thing is that there are so many other great original thinkers whose ideas never saw the light of day. And you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is you will always come across people who say, you know, I don't feel like that's me. And it might or might not, but you definitely know someone who has really great ideas who is looking for a champion.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes supporting those people in their efforts to get their ideas heard is one of the best ways that you can contribute.
And we don't get to see all J.K. Rowling's thrown away drafts either, do we? We don't get to see what she went through or still goes through to just sort of toss them in the bin, as it were. If you just joined,
do we want to see them?
Well, I kind of do. It would make me feel slightly better about that life. But we're talking to Adam Grant. He's the author of Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World, New York Times bestseller. It's available this month in paperback. So let's talk about strategic procrastination. Tell us what that is, Adam.
I was really surprised and a little dismayed to discover that the most creative people often procrastinate more than the rest of us. Or maybe I should say as much as the rest of us. So
sure.
you can draw a spectrum from people who never procrastinate to always. And the sweet spot is in the middle. I have another former student, Jihei Shin, who showed this both in a bunch of organizations and also in some controlled experiments. And what they tended to do was they were quick to start and slow to finish. And what that meant was they would dive into a project early, try to get lots of ideas, but know that if they just started moving forward and implementing their ideas right away, they were probably working with their most conventional thoughts. Like, that's why they came to mind first. They were obvious. And very frequently, creativity depends on nonlinear thinking and incubation, and that can be facilitated by delay, as frustrating as it can be to put off something you're excited about. And so, you know, I think you see this, both Martin Luther King Jr. and Abraham Lincoln in their greatest speeches. We're still revising the day of.
Hmm.
And it's like, hey, if it worked for those two, it could probably work for the rest of us too.
Interesting. And let's touch on parenting again, because there's so many sort of rich anecdotes and research in this book about all kinds of things. And as a parent, some of those parenting conversations jumped out, including this really intriguing study or look at parents of the parenting strategies of people in the Holocaust who were bystanders and those who reached out to help. That's a pretty dramatic story. Tell me how parenting the next generation of nonconformists is done.
Well, one of the mistakes that a lot of parents make is the "because I said so" mistake.
Mm.
And, you know, it's so understandable that, you know, that people, that parents do this, right? It's like frustrating to explain things over and over again. The problem is that when you give the "because I said so," you know, answer over and over again, you either see that kids rebel in, you know, in sort of destructive ways, like they become juvenile delinquents, or they just learn to follow authority blindly. What you want is kids who think for themselves and develop good values. And what you saw with the parents who raised the Holocaust rescuers is that they, instead, when they disciplined their kids, they basically disciplined by having rules that had explanations behind them or values behind them. And so they would say, you know, here's why I was disappointed by what you did. Here's why it's so important to us as a family. Or, you know, like if I were going to say this to our kids, I would say, like, you know, grants are generous, or, you know, grants respect others. And when you do that, you actually teach kids to internalize the values as opposed to just following authority or rebelling. And I think, you know, it's always a set of values that leads people to become comfortable being nonconformists. So here we are.
We are. Adam, I know you have a busy day in front of you. I just want to ask you one more thing and take you back to the foreword of this book, which is written by Sheryl Sandberg, a Facebook Lean In author. And she tells a story about losing her husband, which I think most people who have followed her work know about, and you flying across the country. And she said you helped explain what she could do to build her resilience, as well as just being a friend and a shoulder to cry on. What a portrait of friendship. And I'm wondering, I know it's a private conversation probably, but what can you tell us about building resilience in a tragic situation like that?
Yeah, it was incredibly hard to like to watch, you know, someone I care about go through that, and also to lose somebody that I care about or cared about. And I guess it's not entirely private anymore. So Cheryl and I actually just finished writing a book about resilience, which will come out at the end of April. It's called Option B. And I think one of the biggest things that I learned from that experience was that in the worst of situations, one of the things that helps with recovery is finding gratitude for what you still have. I remember reading a lot of research on this, trying to figure out, you know, what could possibly help. And, you know, Cheryl asking, you know, what do we know? You know, I've heard lots of stories from people, but, you know, as a psychologist, like I think of data as basically learning from lots of people's experiences together. And I remember telling her, you know, that it could be worse. And she said, how could it be worse? I had lost my husband. You know, like my children are without a father. And I said, well, you know, Dave died of a cardiac arrhythmia, and he could have had that while driving your children in the car. And, you know, we both, after that, you know, sort of had this realization that like, it's so important to be grateful for our children. And that's something that most of us take for granted. And I think that just getting into the habit of imagining how things could actually be worse really gives us a lot of strength.
Adam Grant, I'm sorry for your loss, and I am deeply grateful for your work. So thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Adam Grant. Once again, he's the best-selling author of Give and Take and of Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. Both books are now available in paperback. Adam, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too, Lori.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Tonight, President Donald Trump addresses a joint session of Congress. He's set to lay out his agenda for the coming year. NPR is there live with analysis and reaction. Coverage begins on SDPB Radio at 7 Central, 6 Mountain. But first, we thought we'd bring you a conversation we had with historian John Lauck soon after the election. We were digging into the perceived division between rural America and urban America to see if those numbers provided insight into Trump's victory and a preview into his administration. Give me an idea of why look at Donald Trump in the Midwest in the first place. What intrigued you?
Well, first of all, I think lots of people were surprised about the election. Everyone was predicting prior to the vote that Hillary Clinton would win and would win by a large margin. And if you recall the final weeks of the campaign, there was quite a bit of discussion about Hillary Clinton extending her electoral victory by campaigning in Arizona, for example, which is a traditionally Republican state. And I think everyone was thinking they must have been very confident about winning and picking up some additional states that aren't traditionally Democratic. At the same time that Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Arizona, I remember thinking it was strange that Donald Trump was campaigning in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. I remember one morning seeing on the news that he had touched down in Minneapolis and had a rally. And I thought, that seems crazy to me. I mean, does he think he's going to flip Minnesota of all places? And well, in the end, they knew something that we didn't, and they knew something that we weren't paying attention to. Surprisingly, I think this is the most shocking result of the night, was that Donald Trump only lost Minnesota by 1%. I mean, Minnesota is a very Democratic state. It's it had not voted for a Republican since 1972.
When you drove to Minnesota, I remember driving in late October, early November from Sioux Falls to Minneapolis, and all you saw on the way there were Trump signs. out in along the highways and in the smaller towns, that's all you saw. And I remember wondering, does that mean anything at this point, or can you not tell anything from signage?
You know, that's very funny you mentioned that, because I drove to a conference in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I think it was early October, and I drove north through South Dakota up to Summit, and then I cut over on the two-laners into St. Cloud. So this would be rural western Minnesota, central western Minnesota, and I saw the exact same thing. I saw a lot of Trump signs, and I saw zero Clinton signs. And I thought, oh, this is Minnesota. Clinton will win by 25 points here. And I was shocked at the result. But of course, the results in other states in the Midwest were also very shocking. Not as shocking as Minnesota, but in neighboring Wisconsin, Trump won. And he flipped a ton of counties that had previously voted for President Obama, not once, but twice. And Wisconsin had not voted for the Republican nominee for president since 1984. And even 1984 is a bit of an outlier, because 1984 was this massive Reagan landslide where he won 49 states. So it wasn't shocking that he won Wisconsin that year, too. So all of that caused me to think more about what was going on in the Midwest, and why did it change this cycle?
And in this paper you wrote, you kind of go back to the origins of the GOP. Tell us a little bit about some of the roots, where this might have originally taken root.
Well, back in the early 19th century, the political contests in this country were between the Democrats, what we now call the Democrats, and the Whigs. And in the late 1940s, or excuse me, the late 1840s and the early 1850s, the Whig Party imploded. And rising from the ashes was a brand new party started well, there's some debate about this, but most people say it started in Ripon, Wisconsin. That's why we have the Ripon Society today, which is still active in Washington, D.C. But in 1854, it got rolling, and it started organizing not only in Wisconsin, but in Iowa and Michigan. And it was sparked by the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, in which people thought that slavery would be spread west into the new territories in places like Kansas and Nebraska. And that caused this new party to emerge very rapidly, the Republican Party. And it first elected its first president in 1860 in Abraham Lincoln. And it became the dominant party in the Midwest. And the Midwest was associated with the GOP for many, many decades, until things got scrambled around a little bit during the New Deal and the crisis of the Great Depression. And ever since then, the Midwest had been something of a swing region, or some of the key states in the Midwest had been swing states like Ohio and Iowa, et cetera. But in recent decades, a number of these Midwestern states had been seen as solidly blue or part of the Democratic coalition, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, and Illinois, et cetera. But all of a sudden, we broke out of that pattern. People weren't expecting it to happen. It snuck up on us, and everyone was scratching their heads on the morning after the election. But if you look down deep into the data from some of these states, it's pretty amazing how things changed. For example, in Michigan, I think Hillary Clinton ended up winning 8 counties in Michigan. I think there's 83, 84 counties in Michigan. In the end, she only won 8. So that's a massive swing from some of the earlier cycles where the Democrats had done much better and Barack Obama had done much better.
So does it swing back then fairly easily with a stronger candidate from the Democrats? Or are we looking at something that has potential to be a little more of a permanent shift?
That's the big question, and we don't know. It could swing back, but there are signs that Trump has gained, picked up some additional voters in some of these states that are non-traditional Republican voters, and it depends on if they stick with him. And this was something that surprised a lot of observers through the primary season. Everyone was always predicting every week that, well, Trump will finally stumble, this comment will finally cost him votes, he'll finally start to lose his supporters, but it never really happened. He never really lost ground among that core constituency.
Did he have an infrastructure that really campaigned well in the rural Midwest, or was he just an appealing candidate to people here?
Well, that's one of the other things that should be fairly concerning to Democrats, I think, is that it's not my impression that there was much of a campaign infrastructure at all. I mean, his campaign was really focused on rallies and using social media and earned media. And there was not the kind of ground game, for example, that the Bush campaign deployed in 2000 and 2004 in places like Iowa, which became sort of famous for their use of data, for example, or even more famously, the Obama campaign and their use of data. There was nothing like that on the Trump side. So, and you can usually count on a strong ground game giving you an additional 3 to 5 points in a close race. And so the fact that Trump didn't even have that advantage, I think, should be alarming to Democrats. But I also think, looking back on it, we should have seen more signs of how weak Hillary Clinton was as a candidate in some of these states. I mean, after all, she did lose the Michigan primary to Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And in places like Wisconsin, she didn't campaign in Wisconsin after June of 2016. So she, you know, we should have been paying more attention to the problems she was having. But I think we were focused on the big picture and focused on whatever Trump was saying that day. And we lost track of some of those details.
Mm. So early on in his campaign, we were trying to sort of suss out some of his policies that would affect South Dakotans. We were looking into ag policies, not finding a lot. So, and he's certainly not someone who comes from rural roots or would have a, you know, be considered someone with a prominent rural voice. What was it, if it wasn't the policies that he had laid out for farmers and producers, for example? What was he saying, do you think, that really captured the voting spirit of Midwesterners?
Well, if you look down into this data and into some of the election polls, you'll find that Donald Trump won working class white men by a 50% margin. And if you think about South Dakota, the demographics of South Dakota and who lives here and who we are as a people, as a state, we have a very large number of working class white men. And I would think farmers, farmhands, people who work on farms, people that work in small businesses, et cetera. Those would fall into that camp. And Trump did extremely well among that demographic. And if you have a state that is constituted like ours or is made up of this kind of constituency, he's going to do very well here. And he did. He won with 62% of the vote, which was higher. People forget this, but that was higher than Ronald Reagan received in 1984 in the big landslide. So he did extremely well. If you think about the various elements of the famous Obama coalition that put him in the office in 08 and 12, you know, a lot of those constituencies aren't very large in South Dakota. So right. Trump was bound to do well here.
So you mentioned in the paper sort of the masculine ideals, in quotation, those are your words, of from the era of industrialism and working class men. Does that mean gender played a role here? Is this sexism in voting?
Well, what I was talking about there is the role of the old Midwestern working class that we typically associate with Michigan and Detroit and Flint and Pontiac and a lot of those old industrial plants, where those working class voters after the New Deal, you know, into the 1940s or so, you know, 75% of those voters supported Democrats. But since that period of time, that slowly eroded down to the point where Reagan famously won those old Democratic working class voters, and they became known as Reagan Democrats. And the famous bellwether for these voters was Macomb County, Michigan. This is just north of Detroit. It's kind of a small, modest suburban area where a lot of people who worked for General Motors and Ford, et cetera, would live. And this was a county, a swing county in Michigan. This is a way of telling which way the political winds are blowing. This was a county that Barack Obama won twice in 08 and 2012. But that county, Macomb County, full of working class white voters from the Midwest, flipped to Trump in 2016. So again, that's another good bellwether of where this group of voters was going.
So what do politicians have to do, policymakers, leaders, even the media, you mentioned in your work here, what do they have to do to speak rural American? What kind of things do they have to talk about? Because that's kind of what you're saying, too, is there's a cultural divide between the urban, the urban voters and the rural voters.
There is, and I would point people to this very interesting book that just came out by Kathy Kramer. She's a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In the last 10 years, she's been going out into rural Wisconsin and interviewing rural Wisconsin folks about what they care about, what they're concerned about, and how they feel they're treated by the political system and the media. And this is every academic's dream, of course. Kathy's book came out about a month before the election, and the results of the election spoke to exactly what she was talking about. And she talked to these, and I encourage everyone to read it, and she talks to these rural Wisconsinites who say, you know, they're tired of being dictated to by Madison, Wisconsin, and by Milwaukee. It seems like Milwaukee gets all the attention, and that kind of drives the train in Wisconsin. And, you know, she got down to that level of granular detail where you can really see what's happening in some of these rural counties.
John, we're going to have to let you go. Tell me the Kathy Kramer book. What's the title of that? Do you have it on top of your head?
Kathy Kramer's book is entitled The Politics of Resentment. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Kathy is a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
That's historian John Locke. We recorded that conversation on January 3rd. Tonight, President Donald Trump addresses a joint session of Congress. NPR is there with analysis and reaction, including Democrats' response. Coverage begins at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, with a call-in special featuring Brian Lehrer and conservative talk show host Charlie Sykes. President Trump's address is at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Jesse Bailey is the executive director of Pathways Shelter for the Homeless in Yankton, South Dakota. He joins us now in the SDPB studios in Vermilion. Jesse, thanks for stopping by today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start out with some numbers, because the numbers of folks using Pathways has seen a spike. Tell me about that.
Definitely. So in 2015, Pathways served approximately 248 clients. And in 2016, that number jumped to 400 clients. Mm-hmm. And that came primarily with the purchase of a new shelter, purchased an old motel, and turned that into a larger shelter to house more clients. So it went from serving 9 clients at a time to up to 48 clients at a time.
So new name and a new location, and then all of a sudden,
boom,
some pretty significant numbers. Tell me a little bit about the services that the shelter provides.
So primarily we are emergency shelter for individuals and families experiencing homelessness. And we also offer, we like to, more of a all-around services, including we have an emergency solutions grant that allows us to help people financially in certain situations. So for example, we can, there's a program called homelessness prevention. So if someone calls us and perhaps they've received an eviction notice, they aren't going to be able to afford the next month's rent, or the utilities are going to be shut off, depending on their income levels and the price of their rent, as long as they meet the grant guidelines, we can help keep them in their home. Mm-hmm. And also we have a rapid rehousing program for clients who have successfully completed our program and they found a place to go. We can foot the bill for a first month's deposit, first month's rent, and to pay some to get utilities turned on. That way they can save their money for future payments and hopefully create a more financially stable household.
Tell me what you might think some of the differences are between a more densely populated urban area and a town like Yankton, a smaller town, a more rural community, when it comes to homelessness.
I think that so people's idea of homelessness, when you think of a metro area, you see people living under bridges in communities. You see larger shelters who have, you know, 300-400 beds where people come just day in, day out, and it's a first come, first serve basis. That's not what you see in Yankton and in rural communities. I think that people who are experiencing homelessness, they can't afford rent, they can't afford a place to live, so they're couch hopping. They stay with friends, they stay with family members, they find a way to make it work until they're completely out of options. They burn their bridges, they don't have any more money to pay for motel rooms, and that's when they come to us. And the difference, I think, in the larger communities in comparison to communities like ours, We're a smaller shelter. Like I said, we can serve maybe up to 50 people maximum. That allows us to provide more of an individualized case plan for each individual when they come into our shelter. So rather than just being a handout and being a place they can lay their head and get food, we want to be kind of an all-encompassing service to help them learn the skills that they need to get back on their feet, find gainful employment, and find permanent housing.
Are there core problems that you see again and again when people come in that you can sort of point and say, these are some of the social problems that we're seeing, that if we could address those, maybe your numbers would go down?
Certainly. That's a great point. And I think some of the services that we've tried to develop over the last few years also include like financial management, developing social skills, interview skills, hygiene skills. I think those are some of the things that we see, and you can point those out pretty quickly with an individual coming in. And we spot those when we're creating the case plan and just offer them, you know, we don't force people to do anything, but we offer that, hey, we can help you with this or this, and we kind of lay out our case goals together, and we work on those together with the clients.
Who's coming in? Men, women, families? Who are you seeing?
Sure. Off the top of my head, I know we have some statistics of the individual men, women, and children that came in, but All walks of life. There's no rhyme or reason really to who is coming in. We have individual men, individual women. We have families. Primarily, I think last year we had at least one or two families staying with us every month with three or more children. And then we're talking veterans. So all adults, of course. We can't house any youth by themselves. If we do have youth, they have to be with a family.
Sure.
So.
Mental health issues, are you seeing that come in the door often, and how do you sort of approach that in the sense of giving people the services that they really need?
Yeah, we definitely see individuals with mental health issues come to us for assistance, and they're people just like you and me, and they need help as well. We aren't licensed counselors or anything like that, and we don't claim to be able to provide those direct services to them, but we still want to be able to provide what we can for them. So in order for those individuals to receive our services, we require them to have some type of backbone through another agency in town, whether it's Lewis and Clark Behavioral Health or Human Services Center, or perhaps they have a caseworker through a different program in town. That caseworker can focus on their mental health needs while we can focus on their rehabilitative needs with finding work, finding employment, whatever it is that we decide their case goals are.
Sure. If you could wave a magic wand and make something change in the town of Yankton, what would it be?
To be completely honest, I think more bilingual services. That we see a lot of the Hispanic population that comes through, and no one on our staff. Well, we speak very basic Spanish, and there aren't many services provided for that in town. So it makes it really hard for people in those situations to find employment and just to basically communicate with anybody. So it makes it, if we have them in our shelter, we have to use Google Translate quite often, and that's definitely not the most accurate tool. It takes a lot longer to get the ball rolling with those families, if you will.
How long are people staying? It must depend greatly on what their needs are, but what are you seeing there?
We have two basic guidelines for when people come to our shelter. If they come to us without any type of income, we set a two-week guideline for them to find work and to gain that income. And then once they do get that, we extend that to 30 days. Or if someone comes to our shelter and they already have employment or they're receiving SSI or SSDI, we extend that 30 days to find housing. And those are just basic guidelines. We understand that as long as, you know, it may take longer than 30 days to find housing or more than 2 weeks to find work. But the whole idea is, as long as they're working with us and communicating with us to work on their case goals and they're putting forth the effort, they're realizing that we're the hand up, not just the handout. We'll work with them. Our goal is to get everybody back out on their feet and not back on the street.
So do you have daily contact with your clients then, working on a plan to sort of get them out of pathways and into a home?
Right. And for that reason, we actually hired a case manager back in October of 2016. Yeah. We just found that the two staff that we had working with clients were just being spread very thin, and the number of services, or I guess I should say the more in-depth we got with our services, we were being spread thin. So we brought our case manager on to do specifically those things, just to get in touch with the clients every day, say, what can I do to help you? How are you coming on your case goals? What do you need from us? And we found that our success rate has gone up since we brought her in.
How many people come back in? And they're in the shelter, and then they go out, and then they're back?
Last year, we had less than, I think it was 2 or 3% of our clients, so 2 or 3% of 400. And that's not to say they might not come back the next year, but it's from what we've seen, those are our numbers so far, and it's a good result.
Do you have a sense that they've gone to a different town, or that they've stayed in Yankton, found work, and found a place to live?
We generally keep contact with our clients for up to 3 months after they leave the shelter, just to make sure they're doing well, paying bills, keeping their job. And from what we understand, normally they are keeping their job and they're staying in their same apartment. However, we do get word time to time. We get return letters, or we get people calling us saying, hey, where's this past client? And it sounds like they've maybe moved on. But for the most part, they are. They're staying in Yankton, staying in the community, Yankton County, and they are giving back to the community, being a good citizen.
What do you love about your job? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I think the fact that we get to help such a diverse population, and we have a great team of 6 staff right now, and the positivity in our shelter is outstanding. I think I talk to a lot of people from across the state, maybe in larger cities, and the idea of homelessness can be such a negative thing. It's just such a negative topic. But to come and just to see the atmosphere of the shelter, the clients, just how positive they are when they are getting on their feet and they're getting the job interviews and they're getting around and they find a place. And once they get in their place, they have all their furniture and the look on their face is awesome.
Yeah.
Very rewarding.
What do you want the community of Yankton to understand about the people who come to Pathways and then stay in the community to contribute? What do they need to know?
Okay. People who are experiencing homelessness are just like you and me. Maybe they had a hard fall, they had a downfall in life, and they deserve a second chance just like everybody else. And all it takes is just that hand to get them up. Yeah. So
takes a community.
That's right.
Jesse Bailey is Executive Director of Pathways Shelter for the Homeless in Yankton. Jesse, thanks for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks again.